Ow, I banged my finger.
What's that?
Ow. I banged my finger really hard on my watch when I was clapping because I was so good at clapping.
Yeah, so that wasn't an epic clap fail.
No, that was an epic clap success, but so successful.
You sound a little different to me today.
I don't know. In what sense?
Well, I think I'm recording. You're recording. We can hear each other.
Let's call that. Yeah, that's all that matters.
Do you know...
Oh, I've got my hood up. Maybe that's why I'm maybe sound echoey, because I've got my hood up and I'm making a little a little amphitheatre for my ears.
A little amphitheatre for your ears. I like that.
This is a podcast in which two friends talk about the pleasures, absurdities, and imperfections of being human. I'm Simon Ellis.
And I'm Lee Miller. Welcome to Midlifing.
We had a little bit of feedback from my nephew Finn, who said, Lee trying to sing, was it Wet Leg? Lee trying to sing Wet Leg made my week.
I mean, so that was from the week before last. Yes, on the chaise long, on the chaise long, on the chaise long, all day long, on the chaise long.
Wow, you get a little repeat.
Yeah. Do you want your muff? I can't get the words out.
Do I want my what?
Do you want your muffin buttered? Do you want somebody to butter your muffin? You're not allowed it anymore because you're LDLs.
I remember those days when I had my muffins buttered. But now I have to have my muffin dry.
Oh, man. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm pretty good. I've had a good week.
Oh, I'm so...
A little less crazy.
So delighted.
I mean, crazy, but a little less.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you. Good for you, Simon.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you know what? I've been doing a lot of dancing lately. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. No, tell me more.
Well, I think it's relevant to midlifing. Mm-hmm. I've been dancing with a freelance dancer called Katie Coe, who's a very experienced dancer, although younger than me. All the dancers are younger than me.
I mean... It's not a shock.
Oh, she's not that much younger.
But probably like 15, 20 years.
No. Piss off.
I was being mean. Okay, so you've been dancing with tell me about what that's meant for you.
Well, this is I realized something, and this is something I wanted to share as I'm going to call it little C content. Content's becoming like the other C word for us, isn't it? The other one being collaboration, of course.
Of course.
Actually, my students I used to work with at the VCA in Melbourne, I must have been a pretty young teacher at that time, but they got so tired of hearing about collaboration. They did used to call it the other C word.
The other C word. Nice. Yeah.
So the thing that... And also I'm going away next weekend to dance as well.
Oh, where to?
Somewhere not far from you, around Axminster, a place called, close to Beer. I love that there's a place in the UK called Beer.
Mm-hmm.
Branscombe?
Don't know, could be. It's sort of.
You don't know.
North Devon, Somersety way.
Yeah, it's on the coast. So what I did notice, it's occurred to me in the last few months that I think this has been like this since I started dancing, that I'm not that interested in being watched.
Huh.
That I think, I mean, this is kind of hilarious because, you know, I did, after all, have a professional career of dancing while people, I was dancing like people were watching me, actually. And I realized that there's extraordinary pleasure there, but it has nothing to do with being seen or watched.
Okay.
And that, in fact, I think that I dance a whole lot better if I can conjure up the circumstances when, A, I'm either not being watched, or B, I forget, or that it's unimportant that I'm being watched.
Yeah.
I'm not really a performer at heart, I suspect. I don't know if there's such a thing.
Oh, I think there are some people who really enjoy being watched. There must be, mustn't there?
I don't know. I mean, there's lots of people who I probably say who are very experienced performers who throw up every night, you know, that who are, you know, have terrible stage fright, and yet probably still there's something that by the end of it that they've enjoyed.
Yeah, that it's over.
Maybe. But I thought, given your expertise in performance studies...
This feels like it's gonna be a sucker punch. Go on.
No, I didn't mean it that. I was just thinking this is kind of your area of expertise, audiences and watching and performing. And I just thought that you might be curious to hear that. And if there was, is there a conversation to be had about being watched?
I don't know if there is a conversation to be had about being watched from the perspective of my research area, except to say that there is definitely existing research that suggests audiences know the affective state of the person performing.
Oh.
So it's, you know, it's not...
Can you just explain what that means when you say the affective state?
Okay, so affect is kind of like... We might shorthand it to talk about emotions, but it's sort of broader and not that. There's something more. It's less singular than emotions might be. It's sort of a more nuanced arrangement of experiential beingness. So
whoa! Experiential beingness. So hang on. So it's more broad than emotion. So it's not
in the sense that emotion, happy, sad. That they have start and stop. They're quite defined in how we talk about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So affect is kind of like the landscape in which emotions sit. So it might be the admixture of things. It might be, you know,
not a catch-all from. By the way, I'm also fully aware that affect's like, you know, super trendy in our field, not least because I've got lots of PhD students who are looking at affect. So I know.
I hope you're directing them to the book that we wrote in 2016 on this.
Oh, of course I am. I actually buy them a copy when they start. That's why your sales have had a bump lately.
Yeah, I'd noticed that the royalties were just streaming in.
Between that book and this podcast, you must be rolling in gold.
I must be reaching out to literally tens of people.
Tens of people. So yeah, so it's not like an umbrella term for emotions, though.
No.
So it's not like all emotions are a subset of affect.
Oh, we could talk about it in a little bit more detail. I could talk about.
You'll just cut it out.
It's used interchangeably with emotions.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't think that's correct, though. Is
no,
it?
Like it isn't.
You know,
It isn't. But there is. I think the reason that I'm thinking of it as the bucket in which emotions sit, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not. I'm not talking about it as a catch-all, but it's like affect theory has impacted psychology, critical theory, literary theory, gender studies. It's all over the place in terms of. But as you say, it's very trendy right now. I think, I think Tompkins is the person who wrote about it first in the 60s. Yep. Sylvan Tompkins. And Teresa Brennan writes it. But there's lots of people who write about it, about affect theory. Anyway, the reason I would sort of say the affective state of a performer might be understood by an audience member is that if we were to talk about the emotional state of a performer, that's potentially quite linear and also quite confusing, because if we've got Hamlet, who is sad because he's being Hamlet, that
it's quite possibly the best summary of Hamlet ever.
Hamlet. Quite sad because he's Hamlet. We might, you know, we might think about that. We might think about that as the emotion, because that's what's being played.
Sad, yes.
Sad, yeah. And obviously actors will go, oh no, I've got inners and outers, and maybe I'm playing angry as my outer to communicate sadness as my inner. I could be playing, because you can't play an emotion, is what actors will say, is you can't play sad, because sad is a feeling, so you have to play something that is on the surface of sad, which I suppose is where we start to get to unpick what emotion, what affect is.
Affect.
Because emotion is a thing that you feel. Affect is an admixture of the things that you feel, how you communicate that feeling. So last night, this week for me has been a really, it's been a chunky old week, and it finished off quite high temperature for a variety of reasons.
Oh no. I've just realised I didn't. You asked me how my week was, but I didn't get back to ask you how your week was.
It's okay.
What sort of podcasting pal am I?
It's okay. I'll shoehorn my response in anyway, because it's all about me.
Nicely done.
You know, it's nothing that you need to go, oh no, just as in, I'm going away on Tuesday.
I know you are.
To Malta and then to Portugal. So I'm away for a good while, and one of those weeks I'll be on leave, and the other week I'll be at a conference. We've talked about this in previous weeks. It means that I've got a lot of stuff that I'm still trying to just get off my table. So I've got shortlisting for, you know, PhD students. I've got shortlisting for a job that I've advertised for. I've got emails to respond to. I had a symposium all day yesterday of PhDs presenting their work. So I had to read and prepare for that. And that was lovely, but it also meant that I couldn't do the other thing. I've got a day's worth of teaching to do on. There's a lot. So when I say that it's a chunky week, and it was a lot, I don't mean it was emotionally draining or upsetting. I just mean I've been super, super
packing
busy.
Packing it in.
In order that I can have the next 2 weeks where I can focus on the task at hand. Whether that's being at a conference or whether that's cocktails at a conference, or whether that's, you know, being with my parents for their 60th wedding anniversary. I know.
60th.
So, yeah.
Wow.
So I came home last night.
Is that, wait, just a little pause there. Mm-hmm. Is golden 50th?
Oh, gosh.
And what's
silver 60th? Is 25, golden is 50th. I think diamond is 60.
You keep talking, I'll look it up.
Okay, thanks, because I can't remember. So I came home last night and I was a bit frazzled. And my affective state was irritable and sharp and unpleasant. Yeah, I was not a nice partner when I got home. And by bedtime, I was crying because, you know, Bob was saying, oh, it's quite clear that what you thought was stress is actually distress. You're distressed. You need to let this out. And she's very nice, and she didn't shout at me, she didn't get cross, she was just, you know, endlessly supportive, which made me cry. So I say all of that to go,
so this, her being supportive made you cry?
Yeah, of course it did.
Oh, it's so cute. It's so hilarious too, because it's just so human.
Well, I'm just so,
and then someone listening goes, now I'm crying because you're listening, and you know.
A long time ago, I realized I don't know what I feel until I'm at the point where I'm crying about it. And then I can pass it at that point. It's like something needs to open up and spill out for me to be able to look at it.
Like, yeah, we are veering awfully close to expertise here, but that's, I mean, also one of the things I'm fascinated by at the moment is this idea of, it's called interoception, which is really just our capacity to sort of sense our body, things that are going on inside our bodies, which is different from proprioception, our ability to organize ourselves in space or know where we are in space. And anyway, and the thing about it is that emotions are they all effectively feel the same.
Yes.
That there are no differences at a level, at a perceptual level in the body. It's just that we render them in different ways depending on context. Also, the idea that you're feeling one thing, having the same internal sensations and then feeling another thing is just all about context. Anyway.
Jesse J, the pop star, famously says, "Turn your nerves into adrenaline." So there's that sense that you're not nervous, you're excited. That's, you know, and that's an attitudinal shift.
Yeah.
To go back to that idea,
they feel the same. They feel the same in the body.
They feel the same in the body, but it's the story you tell yourself about them.
Hmm. By the way, 60th is Diamond. Yes.
Ah, there we go. They're Diamond.
And
I'm not buying
Sylvan Tompkins. Sylvan Tompkins.
Sylvan, thank you, Sylvan. Sylvan Tompkins. Okay. I think 60s.
You were close. You said, exactly, 60s, yep. Mm.
So just to go back to the idea of the emotions feeling the same in the body, that takes us back to those actors who would say, I can't play sad, I have to play something else because sad is a feeling and I have to perform an action that will communicate sadness.
Sadness.
And so it might be, you know, it might be physical, it might be drooped shoulders, it might be eyes cast down, and being very melodramatic in the way that I'm articulating the communication of emotion. But it could be angry. Like last night, I was performing, my outer was anger, my inner was upset, if we were to utilise that language. So I suppose when we talk about emotions, they're singular. And I don't mean that we only feel one at a time, but it's like there's a word to describe sad, there's a word to describe happy, there's a word to describe scared, but the way that they might be articulated is probably where we start to move closer towards the landscape of affect, because it's not just how they're articulated, but then how they're read. So try to get back onto the, and this is incredibly boring, isn't it?
I don't think it is. But I don't think it is. I think, I'm not the arbiter. You're the arbiter of whether it's boring or not when you come to edit it. But this is interesting.
The thing that you were saying about being looked at is that if you don't enjoy being looked at, even if you are performing visibility, as in look at me, look at me, look at me, but you don't want to be looked at, an audience member will likely understand that you don't want to be looked at because of the effective exchange that's possible through both chemical and electrical entrainment. So the way that we unintentionally and physiologically share information about ourselves.
As social mammals, as massively, uber-social mammals, I've heard us described as.
Yeah. And so we're picking up on all kinds of micro expressions. We're picking up on scent. We're picking up on physical proxemic relationships. There's just all sorts of things that we don't know that we are doing, but we are doing. And so an audience member can be looking at something that looks virtuosic, but still be left cold by it.
I had this experience just recently watching two dancers it was a part of a work. It was performed as part of an evening, and it was, they were incredibly skilled and highly virtuosic, what they're doing. But it really was watching two people in pain just because of this, what was going, and I was very close. So I was registering all the kind of the little things as you've just described, a kind of constant frown, the sort of sense that they didn't really, that they weren't comfortable, all sorts of things which were in direct contrast to the virtuosity of their maneuvers. I'm just going to call them maneuvers because that was a little bit military.
Yeah. Yeah. And that becomes, so if we think about the idea that they don't want to be there, and I don't mean that they don't want to be there in the sense that, there's other stuff.
There are some signs that indicate that there is some anxiety or whatever. Yeah.
Their bandwidth is full and that they can't fully be, I guess we're talking about being present, aren't we?
Oh. Yeah.
And so you've sort of come at this when you were saying that you feel that you're a better dancer when nobody is watching, perhaps because, and I'm asking rather than making a statement, perhaps because it allows you to be more present and more in the moment of what it is that you are doing. and more attentive to what you are doing, rather than thinking about how, you know, that thing that you've said.
Perceived. Or
yeah, how you're perceived, or it's 7 minutes in, they're all wanting to sleep with me.
Although... some new listeners may want a little bit of context for that, but I'm not going to give it. They're just going to stroll through our entire back catalogue to find out the, because I don't know when it was talked about, but it was talked about. Although curiously that was in a particular work in which because of the nature of the director, it was a point of transformation in my understanding of what performing was. And so I took an enormous amount of pleasure, and I probably would argue that, and again, just, and this is because of the register at which the work existed. When I say register, I mean the kinds of things it was doing and the kinds of things that I was asked to attend to while I was performing was right on the money in terms of my experience, my understanding, my abilities. It was challenging, you know, all those things, right? So I totally appreciate the example or the tease, you know, the having a go at me about it. But it was really it was quite a turning point in my understanding of what this bandwidth you've just described is all about. Yeah. But the thing that's, and of course I should say that I'm also doing work, the work I've been doing, the dancing I've been doing is being watched. It's being watched by one other person. But it's not really about whether there are people watching or not. It's about this sense of, well, I'm just going to say, of being judged, or whether I feel like I'm being judged or not.
And when does the judgment come in for you?
Well, if it were in a performance situation, the judgment is it's kind of implicit already in the cultural conventions of the performance. People are coming in to decide whether they like something or not. I know that's, of course, not what people are doing, but there is a certain amount of, also because of the, you know, as I say, culturally, what happens afterwards. Yeah, I like that. Oh, I didn't hate it. You know, those kinds of, those sort of quite instant sort of responses. So that's already going on in the context of a conventional performance. But I think I'm learning, and I think that's partly, this is why I brought this to the table. I think I'm learning what it's like to have fleeting moments of judgment, of being judged, and then being able to let those go.
Mm.
Fleeting.
That sounds, yeah, but still, even in a fleeting moment, that sounds lovely.
Oh, it is. It's a little bit psychedelic. It's so close to the feeling of having taken psychedelics.
Mm.
It really is. I can't, when it stops, I mean, except you don't have a hangover in the same way and all those kinds of things that, and it's a lot cheaper. But also, I should say, I don't have a long history of psychedelic usage.
Yeah, yeah. I like how you're like, oh, I'm clarifying,
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not that I haven't taken them, but it's not like I've got a, you know. And, it's so akin to that in which your sort of sense of in being in the world, it's like it has become super open. And I think that's mostly about being by being free from being judged, more or less, much more than less, means that you can pay attention to what's going on.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, what happens in psychedelics. You basically start paying attention to trees and going, oh my God, I'm one with the sky, etc.
Because, of course, we are.
We are, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's, you heard it here first. Well, perhaps not first. Maybe like 587th here on Midlifing.
But it's also, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? That you can kind of understand why in the 50s and 60s people were saying psychedelics are going to heal the world because they allow us to be more clearly connected to the world, to one another, to recognise that we are all part of this kind of this Gaia system, as opposed to thinking about everything in terms of extraction, What can we get out of the planet? What can we get out of relationships?
What
can
or
we
what
get
can
out
I?
Of...
What can I get out of the planet? What can I?
Yeah. Exactly. I think when I'm saying we, I was meaning I.
You just meant you and me.
Yeah.
It's intriguing. And you know, in a way, this conversation, the way its direction it's going, it does make me end up thinking about, and partly because of that comment, a bit about the kind of rise of individualism, and you know, that's not a recent phenomenon, but that sort of sense of as we've become more atomic, that you know, it means that there's this our kind of I don't know. For me, it's just this sort of this terrible, terrible thing. I've just finished reading a Ted Chiang series of short stories. Do you know Ted Chiang?
Is that he wrote the story of your life. Is that what it's called?
Yes, I think that's exactly what it's called.
Which is the isn't it? And I think it's the book that the film is based on, that I can't remember the name of the film, but Amy Adams is in it.
That's right. I think it's called Contact. No, is that a Jodie Foster film?
Yeah, it's Contact, isn't it? No, that's Jodie. That's one of the few Matthew McConaughey films I've been able to sit through, and that's because we have
I hope Matthew's not a listener, because he's going to be feeling pretty judged by listening to the last three episodes of Midlifing.
I mean, he probably is. And
but he'll be okay.
I think I probably need to roll back and say, I don't think it's Matthew McConaughey that I dislike. I think it's more about, I don't appreciate some of the choices he's made in terms of the types of films he's chosen to make. He makes films that I don't enjoy watching. So that's not the same as I don't like Matthew McConaughey. I have seen him perform in things, and I have enjoyed him. And I'm sure, as a human being, he's a super delight.
What's the very bottom of the list? Just as a slight diversion into Matthew McConaughey, what's the very bottom of the list?
Of films that I couldn't, or things that I couldn't watch. Yeah. True Detective.
Oh. You mean more than Magic Mike?
Is he in Magic Mike?
He's kind of the lead, along with
Channing Tatum's the lead.
Okay, but well, Matthew McConaughey and Channing. I think by that stage in Channing Tatum's career, Matthew McConaughey was the lead.
So I might have managed to efface him, because I can say that. Matthew McConaughey, is he in that film? Whereas Channing Tatum's in that film, that little English guy was in the first one, but apparently he was a bit of a dick on set and he didn't come back with the second one.
I love that you know that about Magic Mike.
Absolutely. And then there's the big guy who was married to the woman from the telly, who was in a DC film. Oh, I can't remember his name, but he has a beard. He was nice. He was in that film. I have no memory.
Listeners, you can just walk away for a couple of minutes while Lee goes on a little, follows his train of thought about things he knows about particular actors. Just leave us for a couple of minutes and then come back. No need to pause. Just keep going. Go, Lee.
I cannot remember that Matthew McConaughey was in that film at all. So, I mean, I'll take your word for it, but I think you might be wrong.
You think I might be wrong?
No, I'm sure you're right. I just can't. Oh, wait a minute. Was he the cowboy dude?
Uh-huh.
Ah, so he was the one who was like, he's a bit skinny. What's he doing in this film for? Okay, right. Gotcha.
He's a bit old. What's he doing in this one? His character
old. I just thought the other ones were like all beefcakey, and they look like Chippendales, and they look like they should be doing dances.
I love it after more than... It's finally we've been able to talk about Chippendales. Finally, after so many years. It's basically why I started, you started this podcast, why I said yes, was because...
So that we could get to the Chippendales.
Exactly. By the way, Arrival is the name of the film.
Arrival!